Good morning, Myco Wizards of the World. We got another killer fucking episode for you this week. I'm not going to dance around it, man. This is Roger Rabbit at the OP Fungi Festival in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State. It's kind of a funny, long story how we got here. If most of y'all have been tuning in, you kind of know the lay of the land by now. I guess, simply put, if you take Roger Rabbit as any bit of importance in your cultivation world, we will have an episode coming out pretty soon as we lead into winter, where he calls out the people that stole his land in Ferry County and is about to ask for all of y'all's help. You can mail letters to the director of the FBI and all sorts of crazy casts of characters to kind of push his case to the forefront of all the corruption that happened in the past, decade for him. But that's not what this episode's about. This episode is about kind of bringing Mark back into the realm of this like new aeon of mushroom world. We had the Telluride Festival, right, for a long period of time. We still have it. I think it's kind of overrated, even though I've never been there. It's just my feeling on the matter. Mushroom parades are one thing, but I don't know. I'm not going to talk shit. Anyways, when David Rogers from Maddie's Mushrooms decided to put on the OP Fungi Fest, he had asked if we would come out. And I said, sure. I didn't know if we'd be donating spawn or what the fuck we'd be doing. Simultaneously, I guess he reached out to Mark and asked if he would be willing to join the festival. And I think there was some apprehension on Mark's part to get reinvolved in this world. I'm not going to name names, but there's plenty of people from the 70s and 80s early mushroom world that generally just suck at life and they want to take all of the credit for themselves. And Mark is not one of those people, even though he did the most work out of anybody in terms of getting cultivators into cultivation. A lot of people who are myco famous, as Neil Brent will put it, it's awesome. It's supporting and helping all of us, don't get me wrong. But it's all the people in the background teaching lab work or cultivation skills with, years of trial and error that are willing to share this information for free that I find so important. And recognition of that is another thing. So I kind of made it my goal to, implant myself and make sure that Mark got to the OP Fungi Fest. So how I pitched it to him was, hey man, like there's a lot of people there who I'm sure will want to meet you, and let's just fucking do it. Let's have a casual conversation. We don't have to bring up any like sensitive or sore subjects. We can just keep it fucking fun and relaxed. And you know what? That's what the fuck it was. It was rad. First off, going to the OP Fungi Festival was really, really fucking cool, man. It's the first time I got to meet a lot of people that I've just been chatting with or working with or consulting for over the years. Ken, it was rad to meet Chicago Ken, as I call him, and his new business partner for Fruiting Bodies, which is a lab out of Mass doing like cordyceps chocolate bars and all sorts of cool shit. So you should check them out. And I got to meet his business partners, along with, Robert Rogers. That was great to chat with him and Roger Rabbit and a bunch of people just kind of in a circle. Amanda was there from KM with her homie. And, it was pretty cool. It was great to see Alex Dorr in person and, sort of get to link up with a bunch of interesting cats. Philip from Washington, new homie. There's a lot of people who live out that way and they have been interested in mushrooms for a long time, but breaking into the cultivation side of it I almost feel like they don't realize how big it is until they go to a festival like that. And they're like, wow, there's one of these festivals in practically every portion of the country in the good part of the years. Now, so we'll see what next year brings. You know, Far West is doing their Fungi Festival, all that goodness. I don't know that I'll be going to too many, but I think that it's really exciting to go to them and to meet new people. I'd have never met, you know, Alan Rockefeller, or I wouldn't have seen Sam Shoemaker do a pretty excellent talk on mycomaterials. I just wouldn't have been in that scene. And I think it's so important to, you know, make sure that these events happen specifically for really innovative stuff, for cultivation techniques, identification, the whole nine yards. It's great, you know. So don't get me wrong, I'm sure Telluride is great, but these small ones do it for me. I don't know what it is. So good for you, David, for putting this fucking shit together. It really really comes down to that. David believes in what he's doing, and if you don't know about David Rogers, check out our episode with him of Maddie's Mushrooms, and you know, kind of leave the OP Fungi Festival at that. It was great to spend more time with Mark. He's getting sort of like in this weird Zen state with motorcycles and acceptance of this like stolen property situation. And I don't know. It was a good visit. It was just, you know, me and him spent the day basically riding from the airport, packing up motorcycles, and departing from down Seattle way, and riding up the OP Olympic Peninsula area. I met this great woman on a plane. She knew way too much about mushrooms. She's from Olympia. I don't know a lot of people out there. It's like New England. We talk shit on, you know, one state or another, or one town or another, or part of a town. So it's kind of funny to the entire plane ride hear about all of the complexities of living on the Olympic Peninsula. Doesn't really matter to me, man. I just had a blast fucking riding in the rain with Roger Rabbit, and getting to sit down with him in front of an audience and sort of share some conversation with a lot of people who are old school supporters of him and new ones at the same time. And thank you so much for everybody who came out to that. That really meant the world, and, you know, made it worth it. I think, and it's going to drag his ass back into it, I hope. Not in a crazy way, you know, he's not going to start up another mushroom farm, but I hope he can realize his importance in the industry and continue to sort of step into it and step out of it as time permits. Historically, RR was a weed grower. He traveled the world flying planes, working for different broadcast companies, doing electrical and engineering work and stuff. And on his off days, he would, like, you know, scour into the, you know, desolate areas of Africa and different parts of the world and find land-raised strains of weed and bring them back to the States and cultivate them. He's a weed guy. That's his whole thing. I learned more about weed spending time with fucking RR than anything else, which is funny because I just don't grow weed. It's like, just not, plants are funny. I don't know. They're not my thing, but I think they're magical. They're freaking sweet to watch, but it just has never captivated me in the same way as the systems specific to cultivating mushrooms. So that's his background. He was growing weed, growing psilocybin, taking massive doses with his late wife at their spot out there in eastern Washington. And then he met and spent a lot of time with John Holiday, along with a bunch of other folks like Stamets, throughout, you know, the evergreen days of Stamets' early realization of who he was, right? Or who he was going to become. And in that time period, he got more and more invested in gourmets, specifically shiitakes and cordyceps and lion's mane and all of these things, because his late wife had been diagnosed with cancer. And she survived a long time. You know, she had almost, I think, over 10 years, if I'm not mistaken. And a lot of that can be attributed to mushrooms, good health, clean air, exercise, plenty of those things. But at the end of the day, when she started to, you know, have a decline in health, and then eventually passed away, I think Mark sort of saw gourmet mushrooms as a failure to saving his wife. Therefore, he dropped out of it. The perception was he went back to weed. That's not the reality. The reality is, a really long battle began for the ownership over his property where his wife had died, and a lot had happened, and we all know that property just from the videos and from the forums and the posts on Shroomery and stuff. So it's immensely important to recognize that the chronological order of these happenings is kind of why I think Mark faded to the outside. You know, he's also a private dude. He's not interested in taking the fucking limelight, which is what's so goddamn awesome about the dude. Needless to say, it was really awesome to bring him out to the Fungi Festival. It was great. Got to touch base with other podcast people like Flora Fungi Podcast. That was super fucking rad. And hopefully we'll get to do something or work together in the future. And yeah, man, I don't know. I'm sure I'm skipping something here because it's not like a seminal episode. But man, here's the talk from Roger Rabbit and I from the OP Fungi Fest, and hope you enjoy it. If you like this content and you want more of it, and you want some of the videos and deep dives and cultivation information, head on over to MichaelWizards.com. We got different tiers. You can join our culture club, get a free culture of the month in the mail every month, a different phenotype from our cryo storage. You can sign up just for the deep dives. You can just support the podcast with $5. Fuck, man, we're about to do a Micah Wizards lunchbox where every month in the mail you get some product from one of the farms that we interview or support. That's going to be bitching. We're starting off the whole Micah Wizards lunchbox thing with Joe from Cactus Hat Mushrooms down in Tampa, Florida. So if you're signed up for it, you're going to get a bag of Lion's Mane coffee in the mail pretty soon here. And if you haven't gotten it already, by the time this recording comes out, and then we'll march on down the line and get people sort of cool products from jerkies to tinctures to, you know, liquid cultures to whatever, you know. We just want to show what these companies are making and really kind of put them on blast because, man, they're the people of the industry. They're the fucking customers of Cap and Stem or just the homies of us and the Micah Wizards crew, and it's a big fucking family. It's what we all want at the end of the day, am I right?
It's all about the family.
No, I'm not going to go off and do an ICP thing. Fuck ICP. Watch, I'll get a death threat for that. Anyways. All right, man. Roger Rabbit, OP Fungi Festival. Thanks for bearing in as I kind of spill random words about this episode. And do keep your eyes out for the impending third episode with Roger Rabbit, where Mike and I spent the day traveling and hiking mountains with the motherfucker, only to find a sweet spot in the woods to stage up and set up cameras and actually spit the names of the sons of bitches that stole a lot of shit from him. And with that episode, we'll sort of release how you can help him out and who you can send letters to and so on and so forth, because even in a digital age, if your mailbox is physically full of fucking snail mail, you just know somebody's coming for you. All right. Lots of love, Micah people. Enjoy this interview with Mark R. Keith or Roger Rabbit.
There you go. Oh, that one. Ow. I love these clippy mics.
I think on one of them we did. Mine was turned off because I could still hear myself when I listened to it, but it was 3 years.
Dude, you're like cooking food or something. Yeah.
Yeah, we're sitting there chewing and doing a podcast to eat. It was rude as hell. It makes
it real. Yeah, it does, man. It makes it way too real. Oh, man. All right, let's see how that goes.
Does that go up a little bit?
Nah, fuck it.
How's it going, everybody?
Is that too far?
You guys can hear without mics, right?
Yeah, can you hear without mics? I don't know what makes the difference. We'll just make them look cool, like right in front of us.
If we see them doing this, we'll go, okay, they're gone.
Yeah, that's true.
We saw that yesterday a little bit. No, I'm just fucking.
We'll just stare at you as we're talking. This is Mark Keith. I don't know. How many of you are here? Because that's fucking Mark Keith. Yeah, here you go.
Eric Lohman.
Oh, shit, yeah. Yeah,
come on.
No, man, I started the Micah Wizards podcast been like 3 years or something like that. And I did my first interview was with these two that came up from Nearby Naturals, who was like a hot and heavy block company that came right out of the pandemic. And they're slaying it. It was rad. We're doing a lot of fulfillment for them in our farm in Maine. And I said something about Roger Rabbit on that interview, and they didn't know who the fuck he was. And I was like, fuck everybody. I was like, all right. Now I got to go find him.
You executed him on the spot.
Yeah, I just killed him. That was it. Yeah. But I was like, this blows my mind. There's so many people coming into the mushroom industry now who just have zero, they don't have a footing into anything but what is the Stamets world, you know? Yeah, the history's huge, man. So I kind of made it my point to find you, and it took a minute. But he's a hard-to-find guy, man. He stays hidden, you know?
You got as many ex-wives as I do. You learn. Yeah. Kind of your tracks, you know.
Yeah. You got to change your address every couple days or so, you know?
I'm up to years.
Yeah.
Been in Seattle 3 years. That's pretty
good.
That's
good.
I was in New York for 3.
Nobody's chasing you out.
Not yet.
All right. Well, I don't know. I learned a lot from Mark in particular, just from early cultivation. Are you guys mostly cultivators, or are you guys just excited podcaster. About mushrooms? What's that?
Podcaster.
Oh, you're on the spot, buddy, now. Fuck, dude. You got a pro in the audience.
What's your podcast?
Flora Funga Podcast.
Oh, I saw your thing over there. Hell yeah. All right, cool.
Well, nice.
Well, you can have this audio if you want it. It can be yours, man. I don't know. There you go. Is that what that's doing?
It's very cool.
It's video. It's audio.
Check your fly.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how many people are like aware of all of the, maybe some of the older cats here, everything that kind of Mark put into this, but I built like my entire farm and infrastructure based on these things. So like, I think it was 2006 or 2007 that I copied your double barrel steam boiler. And I don't know, when did you build that originally?
About then.
Yeah?
Yeah, about then. It would have been a little later. We bought that property in 2007.
2007.
And moved in and almost immediately built that.
Okay.
Just experimenting. Everybody was using autoclays for everything at the time. Or trying to pasteurize in a big pot. And you just couldn't do anything. And I was wondering, because I was using supplemented sawdust at the time. So you put grains in it, you pretty much have to sterilize. And so what I was trying to do was stack, I had, you know, a couple of AA 141s or 41s, whatever they are, the big one. What was big at the time, you know, like, this is a massive pressure. It holds 24 jars, man. But trying to use a series of those and loading up the circuits and all of that, I just wondered if you could do atmospheric sterilization, just steam only, leave the vent open and have steam plus convection, and do it for longer and see if that would work.
Yeah.
And I was at about 3,800 feet elevation, so water boils around 98°C there. So my steam wasn't quite 212 degrees, but I would let it run for a little bit longer. And I started with 8 hours and ended up cutting it back some, but it worked, you know? So saved an awful lot of money. It allowed me to scale up and start growing enough to sell and make a little bit.
I think that like encouraged like endless amounts of cultivators from like that point forward, even if they weren't on the shroomery and they just stumbled across like the mushroom videos series that you did, they were just like, fuck man, I don't have to get a giant canning retort. Cause that was kind of the pivot where everybody was like, you have to do this. And I think you kind of made it accessible to an obscene degree to like a lot of people. And they were like, ooh.
Well, and then there was the whole secrecy thing. In the early days, you'd go to a conference like this and there'd be workshops. And yeah, maybe somebody was mixing straw and showing how to get the grain spawn in it. Great. So you say, well, now how do you make the grain spawn? Well, that's proprietary.
Yeah.
We sell it on our site. Or you can mail order it, you know. And nobody wanted to say anything. And then when people started making spore syringes, everybody thought everybody else's spore syringe, but theirs was crap.
Right.
You know? Somebody's selling plain water. Mine are better because they're so dark you can't hardly see through it. You know? Well, that don't make it better. But then we had the whole Spore Wars thing. I think you were asking about some of that earlier.
And that was like pre-shroomery. That was like
That was most of that was alt drugs, mushrooms on the Usenet back in the day. I was Sky Pilot. I hadn't iterated Roger Rabbit at that point. And most of us thought it was silly, and people were pretty open about sharing their information. Fanaticus would come in, McPherson would come in there. Most of the guys would come in on that group from time to time, and then migrated. Hippie 3 started Mycotopia.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I joined there a little while after that. He was still on the Usenet some.
Yeah.
And then Shroomery started about the same time, I think. But I was over at Mycotopia, and Hippie 3 was like, no, Shroomery's the enemy, you know, you can't go over there. And he had an account there, but when I made an account, he was all mad and shit. So that stuff was kind of funny. I can laugh about it now. Hippie 3's biggest gripe with me, and I thought it was funny, I banned him. And I asked the admin, as soon as I banned him, I went into the mod forum and I said, guys, please, whatever you do, don't unban him. Let me do it. I just want to watch him steam for a while, because he was, I didn't realize he was sick. You know, when somebody's sick and they know they're near their end, a lot of people get angry. They think, I didn't get recognized for what I did. And that anger comes out. And I think it was some of that, and I didn't realize it. See? Yeah. So I thought, oh, he's just being a jerk. Like, I'm going to ban him, you know? And I banned him for something he posted at Mycotopia. That's what made him so mad.
Oh, you banned him on the stream?
Something did it, sure. Yeah. Were you asking something? Okay. Yeah. But anyway, that was just a byproduct of it. The Spore Wars was, I guess, all about economics. People were competing for a limited market. The internet was brand new. McPherson was selling his in High Times for a long time, pre-internet. You'd have an ad in High Times, and then I think it might have been John Allen. I should have asked him before I came over here, because I even bought one of the mushroom kits they sold back in the late 80s, and it was not a Petri. It had a test tube with some bird seed in it, and there was a little cotton thing like gum used to come in or something, those little cloth bags.
Yeah.
And that had the spores, and that was in another test tube. And the instructions were to heat your oven up, and you stick inside the oven, and you transfer from one to the other. So I got my oven out and got it all. I'm thinking, why the oven, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it sterilizes the air. And I'm thinking, it's hot, so it makes a low pressure area. When you push molecules apart, you make low pressure. Well, what happens when you have low pressure? The high pressure rushes in. And I'm going, how is that possibly helping anything? So I did it, and it got all green, and I didn't get anything out of it. So I ordered another one, and this time I did it on the countertop after cleaning everything down and tried not to spit on it. And it worked. Just probably dumb luck, but real quickly, the direction said, real quickly, take your sterile I think it was spores. Anyway, whatever it was. It actually worked, and I managed to grow a mushroom or two on it. I thought, well, this is really neat. I'd already been growing them outdoors, but I had never tried the indoor.
That was your first attempt inside.
That was my first attempt to bring them indoors. I thought, you can do this indoors.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you told me the story. Maybe some people have heard this already, but your first encounter with mushrooms is pretty first fucking rad story.
Yeah, if you heard his podcast, you already know this story.
Go
back and watch.
Shit. Yeah. I'm not that cool. Yeah.
I had just moved to Dallas, and this would have been 1972. So I'm 18 years old, freshly married, moved to Dallas, Texas, and I had no weed, you know, and I'm going, fuck, I don't know anybody. No kids, good. So anyway, the way we used to always get weed back in the day is you'd drive around until you found a freak hitchhiking. And in those days, anybody with long hair, that's a freak.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we called ourselves. You go up to somebody and say, hey, you freak? And that meant, you got me weed. You know, that's the whole thing. Because if somebody had long hair, obviously they got weed or no. So anyway, I go out driving around, and I'm looking for a hitchhiker because I want to score some weed. And I found me one, long hair and everything. And he goes, I got a joint right here. He goes, I can get you a bag. But he goes, I'm trying to get out to Tyler to pick some shrooms. And I'm thinking, why would you go all the way to Tyler? Can't you go to the grocery store or something, you know? And he goes, no, I'm talking magic mushrooms. And I thought, oh, fuck, I've heard of them, but I've never picked them. He goes, well, if you'll give me a ride, it was about a two-hour drive, Dallas to out by Tyler, East Texas. He goes, well, if you give me a ride, I'll turn you on to some of my patches. He didn't tell me the farmers come out with their shotguns and shit. He left that out.
Yeah, yeah.
Until I had about five or six of them in me and were dragging these 55-gallon trash can bags. And here comes the farmer. Like, he goes, hurry, get in your van.
Kabow.
So anyway, we picked, I think that day we picked just garbage load of mushrooms, you know, way more than we could eat. I was just, this is fascinating, you know. We filled several of those big lawn and leaf bags.
Yeah.
Big, huge bags full of cubenzies. Dragged them back to Dallas, and I thought, man, this takes about three of these to equal a hit of acid. And yeah, back then, a hit of acid was $3 to $5.
He told you this? It was like three for a hit?
He said, yeah. He goes, because we were getting ready to go, and he goes, be careful with those. He goes, about three equals a hit of acid. And I'd already eaten about half a dozen by that point. I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a fun drive. So we get the mushrooms loaded up, get out, and we're driving back. And that was rather exciting drive back because the white line would not stay under my freaking car. And it kept moving, and I'm trying to catch the white line. And this guy's going, my hitchhiker, you know, he's going, I'm going to die. And he's going, move over. I go, I'm trying. It's not me. It's the freaking white line. I'm trying to keep the car. So he goes, take this exit before we die. You know, so I just suggested, oh, yeah, take this exit. And there was a cemetery right there. He goes, pull in there to the cemetery. So we pull into the cemetery, and suddenly he's, he didn't need any, you know. He's like, no, don't even.
Stone sober. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's going, oh, I'm going to live. I'm going to live. I'm going to live. So we walked around the cemetery and chatted and stuff till I was straight. But anyway, get home and started hanging them up with monofilament line and stuff to dry out in the garage.
Yeah.
But couldn't get all those bags, couldn't get them all hung up in time. So one of them went rotten. I opened it up and it just putrid stink. So I thought, oh, I'll just compost these. So I took them out. I had a big compost pile and dumped them into the compost pile. Says, man, let's turn these things in and hopefully they'll, you know, break down before I need to use it for my weed. That's what the compost pile was for. And then I just forgot about them. And a couple of months went by. I don't remember how long, but had a good rainy spell, thunderstorms or something. And I looked out there and my whole compost pile was yellow. Kind of just gold and yellow, and I'm thinking, did I put a cover over it? Yeah, I went out there and looked, and it was cubes just everywhere. Thousands and thousands of them had come out of that compost pile. And at that time, I thought they were plants. I didn't know anything about them.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, they must have been cuttings, and they rooted in there, and because I could see the mycelium, I thought, well, obviously, any idiot can tell that's roots, right? So it's a plant. Those are the roots. And I thought I'd learned how to grow a plant, you know? And then from there, I started reading about it, trying to figure out, well, what is it that I did? Why did this happen? You know, then I learned it was fungus. There was no books at the time at all. I found one in a library.
And this was like 1970, right?
This was in 1972 and 70. Three.
Right. Yeah.
50 years ago. Wow. Anyway, I found this book, and I think it was Paris. It's either Paris or London. There's catacombs under the city. I'm pretty sure it was Paris. But it was a book about how they were growing mushrooms underground, and it showed some pictures of these long compost piles and mushrooms coming out. I go, well, that's exactly what I did, you know, by accident. But this is what they're doing on purpose. And they were doing manure to manure and compost to compost transfers because it had you mix up your bucket load of spawn. I don't remember now what they were using. But they would get the spawn mixed up and culture and then put it into the more compost.
Right.
And wheelbarrow loads into more compost. It was all done by hand with shovels. It showed all these pictures of guys shoveling stuff. But they were growing a lot of mushrooms, white button mushrooms. And so I started experimenting with that. And the mushrooms were a side benefit.
Yeah.
And then I was in Oklahoma. I was growing weed at the time, and there was a problem there with root knot nematodes, and they will crawl into your any woody stemmed plant. They're real bad. They eat up carrots too. But I didn't know what it was at first, but I would have a beautiful plant And then the next day it'd be a little bit yellow, and the next day it'd be laying on its side. I never saw anything that would kill a plant just like that.
Yeah.
And I would go to pick it up, and it would just break off. The roots would stay in the ground. I thought, well, it's got root rot, but I'm not overwatering. You know, what is it? So I'd look at it, and you could see just tunneling all through it, microscopic tunneling.
Yeah.
And what is it? And then I was using my compost that had the cubensis mycelium for my weed, but I always didn't have enough. So I would have like 2/3 of the patch, and the rest of it I'd go to the store and buy a bag of steer manure or something, dump in them. And I noticed that none of the ones that had cubensis mycelium in the compost would get nematodes. But the ones that I use store-bought steer manure, they grow just as well.
Yeah.
But they would get nematodes and die. So that's when I got to looking at it and finding out. Finally, I got a microscope, and I could see the creatures. They're little bitty pinworm. I think it might be the same creature that our dogs get when they have worms.
Yeah, yeah.
It's their soil-borne stage.
Right.
But little bitty tiny worms, and the cubensis mycelium, which we now know oyster works too,
yeah.
Traps them. I guess traps them and eats them or digests them or something.
It's like similar to what Sam was talking about the other day. Yeah, or somebody was talking about that. They're talking. Oh, he was on his phone. You motherfucker. No, I'm just joking. No, what were you talking about in regards to like insects? I forget what we were talking about in the parking lot yesterday. It's a long ride up here. Yeah, maybe it could have been. We were talking about like
one that ate a tiger moth or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was some sort of mycelium, but it was just like an innate whatever, and it somehow impacted the bugs, unlike a cordyceps or something, but
yeah.
It just completely annihilates them.
Well, that's apparently what cubensis and oysters and who knows what else does.
Yeah.
They apparently crawl into it and die. Either that or they crawl into it and turn around and leave. I don't know, but I know it quit. The plants quit dying from it.
Right.
And people are putting like garden stropharia and stuff like that in.
Right.
And it helps your plants. Now, it can do that a lot of ways, even if it's not truly mycorrhizal, because the mushroom mycelium will break down the other nutrients in the soil and make them available to the plants.
Right.
And whether they trap the nematodes or not, I don't know. But that was just a curious thing I thought,
yeah,
that the mycelium did that, because once I realized it, I just made a whole lot more spawn, and
right,
by then I was already making grain spawn, and so I just had enough to inoculate everything.
That's wild. And this is when you're already up in Washington then, so you're like...
This is way before Washington.
Way before Washington?
Way
okay,
before,
yeah.
This was back when I was a child.
So mycelium...
20s, I was in my 20s, I was a kid.
Running around, you were on your fourth wife by then?
I was three or four, yeah. I used to change wives like shoes, but... picking them for all the wrong reasons, you know. They were all really hot. But
it's motorcycles and
mushrooms. Not the best criteria for a long-term relationship, you know. Especially if you got ADHD and you're constantly, she's like, well, last week you were into this. Now you're into this. Why don't you? I was like, well.
I like that you've gone like all over the place just in like a way in which you can keep your passions and obsessive compulsive nature going, like searching for weed in Africa to come back and grow more mushrooms, and just it's all like narrowed in on how you've traveled around, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And you've got killer stories from
it's
that.
Fun. It's fun, yeah. I like to have fun. That's the thing. And that's, I raised my kids. Of course, all kids rebel against their parents, right?
Yeah, yeah,
we
yeah.
did against our parents. Their parents rebelled against their parents. And so my kids were raised really, really liberal. And, you know, their friends, all this is Oklahoma. So their friends are all, you got to come to church. You're going to burn in hell. If you want to go to church, I don't care. I don't go, you know, and I don't believe in it. But if you want to, you know, you do what you want to do. And I raised them completely, you know, to make their own choices. So they all three grew up and started going to church. I thought, but they got enough of my genes in them that they've seen the light of day. They don't do that anymore. They wanted to be in the will.
They wanted their rights to the mushrooms.
Yeah, you know. But I instilled that curiosity in my kids, and they've all taken the entrepreneurial route too.
Yeah.
And so they had to be exposed to that. If you have parents that it's strictly, we're going to go do our 40 hours and go home and go to church on Sunday and have 2.3 kids and a dog, you know. The kids, a lot of times, if they're not rebels, they grow up and do the same thing.
Right.
They follow in that path. and maybe 5% of us are rebels. And, you know, my parents were strictly, real strict, fundamentalist Christian. So I grew up with all these strict rules, couldn't do anything. And so it made a better outlaw out of me because I had to sneak to get away from my parents so I could do things and they wouldn't find out.
Right.
No, now my little brother wasn't as good at it. He'd get caught a lot. And I remember one time I died laughing. I'm in my room and I just ate a half a hit of acid. I'm like 15. And she's yelling at my younger brother, "Why can't you be more like Mark? He never gets in trouble." And I'm sitting there like tripping my ass off, you know, making pictures on the wall and shit. So I told him, I got the kid. I go, "Dude, you know, do what you're going to do.
Yeah.
But if you can get away with it, it's as good as not doing it. You didn't get caught, so good. Yeah. You know, if you're going to break the rule, be smart about it." Right?
Yeah.
So he did, and he's now successful in what he does. And
it's carried on.
Yeah, you know, you got to do your stuff and move on. But
it's true, man.
But as far as mushrooms go, I think that whole deal, even as late, I went to a mushroom conference in 2015. And it was here, actually, it was right up the road in Port Townsend. And Paul was there, a bunch of the guys, a bunch of the old timers were there.
Yeah.
But the thing that I heard more than any other two words was, "No comment." You'd ask them a technical question and they don't want to give the answers.
Really?
Yeah.
No shit.
You can buy this or you can buy that, but we're not going to just tell you the answer. I'm thinking, well, why are they even here at a mushroom conference if they're going to talk about what mushroom gods they are and not share?
Right.
You know, and so that was the whole deal with making all the posts at Shroomery is I almost got religious about wanting to unlock what this was. Because I'm OCD, so if I get into motorcycles, I'm 100% into motorcycles. If I'm flying airplanes, I'm 100% into flying airplanes. And with mushrooms, it's the same way. I want to reach and learn what I can and what I'm able to. Now there's guys, you know, like Alan taking it to a whole nother level.
I can't keep up with that dude. Yeah, he's insane.
Yeah, you can't. And there's people like that in every field that take things to the limit.
Yeah.
You know, my deal was the growing part of it. I don't have a medical or a science background to go into that part of it, but I could figure out the growing part. You know, and
systems are inherent to like what any of us have tried to build who own a mushroom farm or have tried to cultivate on any scale. And you can't figure that stuff out in some engineering aspect or have somebody to lean on to show you. It's like you're just going to spin wheels trying to figure this shit out.
Mushroom farmers become engineers pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. Because you can't afford to have somebody come out and build everything for you.
No, man.
You know, and that 55-gallon drum boil, everybody wants to build one. I made the first one, I think silver solder on the first couple, and then I went to brazing. But a lot of people are scared of that. So, they just don't. They don't have the equipment.
Yeah,
right, and they don't know how to weld. You know, nor do I. I burn holes and shit all the time. They got to fix it with something else. But anyway, I made one of those using JB Weld. And it worked.
Holy shit.
I got a hole saw using 3/4 pipe threads.
Yeah.
I got the right hole saw so it'd start. And then I gooped up the threads with JB Weld, screwed it in tight, and put some on the outside.
Oh, cool. That's a
sick tool. I'm pretty sure JB Weld is made right here.
And
it's like $4, you know. And it works.
Well, that's the nice part about the mushroom farming side is like, I think everybody who comes in from the cube side or the gourmet side, they don't even realize like how much money they have to spend to get these things going. And it's like, if you can find ways to do it just by plumbing in fucking whatever with JB Weld and it works, you didn't kill
Make
anybody.
Make it mechanical, secure steel to steel or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And the JB Weld seals it and keeps it from backing out and stuff. But yeah, the thing is people need to always be experimenting and don't ever be afraid you're going to make something and it won't work.
Yeah.
Just don't tell anybody, right? You know? Because one of my favorite, we were talking about this yesterday, Thomas Edison, when he invented the light bulb, he didn't really invent it. He developed it over a long time. Because we knew from the time they first started running wires down the road, I've got the very first National Electrical Code book, as a matter of fact. And when it talks about sizing wires and current flows, now we got a section in the book about that thick with all these tables of this gauge wire at this temperature carries that current. You got to do all this engineering stuff. Well, the very first electrical code book says cables shall be sized so as to avoid excess heat.
Right.
Okay. Because what they knew right away is if your wire is too small, it lights up and eventually burns in half. And so Thomas was thinking, well, how do we put that to work? You know, so he's experimenting with all these different materials, making them glow, but the oxygen kept getting to them and burning them up. And so then he came up with the idea of a vacuum. And I think the first time it was like vacuumed the whole room, made a vacuum, and it worked longer. Instead of burning out in 2 seconds, he got like 5 to 10.
He was like using tungsten? Is that what you're saying?
He was eventually, I think, settled on tungsten. He was trying it with everything. Because he didn't just have charts and books to sit down and do the engineering. He had to try this. Well, that didn't work. Let's try this. That didn't work. Try something else. Right. But his quote, I think it was on my signature at Schrumery, it says, I've never had a failed experiment. I've only discovered 10,000 methods which do not work. And if you look at it that way, you know, you keep trying something no matter how far out it is. Eventually, you're going to hit. It's the law of numbers. You know, it's just playing the math. It's like gambling. You're eventually going to hit. But if you don't do it, you're guaranteed to fail. That's what I tried to instill in my kids is go out and make mistakes. You know, you got an idea for a different kind of bicycle, make one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you learn a lot. And I know it's like it's a cheesy Terrence McKenna quote that gets brought up a lot, but you learn way more about yourself trying to grow mushrooms than eating a bunch of mushrooms. And it's just that trial and error of like continually chasing these things down and trying to figure out systems that can actually be efficient at scale. And I don't know, it leads me to your like your container dome, your, I don't know what you call it, the like container grow.
The shipping container?
Yeah.
Buried in the ground.
But I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, there's no fucking way that will work if you just like pour dirt all the way over it. I just assumed it would just eat away at the seal.
Oh, you got to support
and cave in. Right.
And cave in the sides too. You got to, when you backfill them, if anybody buries a shipping container.
Have you guys seen this? Anybody? You know this buried shipping container? Some of you.
It's an 8x40 shipping container. But earth weighs roughly 3,500 pounds per cubic yard. So if you've got 3 feet of dirt above you, that means every 3 feet has 3,500 pounds.
Right.
Right. In that 3 foot, in those 9 square feet, you've got 3,500 pounds of load.
Yeah.
And that's repeated every 3 feet. And so those shipping containers, like number 12 sheet metal.
Yeah.
So you've got to support them at least twice. I ran beams down, two of them down the top. I used 2-inch square steel tubing, 1/4-inch thick, 2-inch square tubing, and ran a header all the way along the roof and then support posts down.
Yeah.
And that held it. But as soon as we started backfilling, I could see the sides poofing in. And so we stopped and I cut some 2x6s and just made them, you know, the length they needed to be, and then made a little bit longer and beat them with a hammer, you know, and got them in place on the sides. And then once we had backfilled and everything settled, a couple of days later, I went in with a sledgehammer and knocked them all out. They weren't nailed. They were just to keep the sides from caving in.
Yeah.
So make sure you do that. And then I put vents out the back. I went to the far back end of it, and I bought some 12-inch, I got well casing material from the secondhand from the well place, but it was 12-inch pipe, and I ran two of those up so it would naturally create a draft like your chimney. You know, if you go in the middle of the summer to your fireplace and light a match or something, you'll see there's a draft just from lower pressure air above, higher pressure air in your living room. It makes that flow. So I had windows in the front of it, air flowed through and out the top, but it worked. And it never got less than about 50 degrees. Where I lived in eastern Washington up by the border, it gets down 25, 30 below. I saw it 40 below once.
Yeah.
At 30 below, the grow room with no heat stayed right at 50 degrees. And that's with air coming in.
Yeah.
That's with air coming in, flowing through and going out. It would just make, and it would draw that heat from the ground.
Yeah.
And then when 502 went through here in Washington, I set up a cannabis business in that same container. And my intention was to do it modular, and because I had enough room to put about 20 of those in.
In that hillside.
In that hillside, yeah, that same hillside. I was going to stack them.
Wow.
But the same principle was at work. When the lights were on, you got a lot of heat.
Yeah.
And the earth would absorb that heat and keep the grow room right around 80 degrees.
Yeah.
Even in the summer, when it's 100 outside, bring 100 degree air in, it would cool it, even with all those lights, and then it would exhaust. I had exhaust fans in the back to take it out. But then at night, it would feed that heat right back in. The ground, the earth would store that excess heat.
Yeah,
and then at night, it would stay about 70. I'd close it up, and when the lights came on the next morning, it was right at 70.
I'm pretty sure you're the only person I know who's done that. Can all of us kind of lean on these ideas of like using geothermal technology to some degree?
Use what you have.
You know?
Use the earth because, you know, that's why slabs. That's why the motel bathroom floor was cold this morning.
Right.
It's built on a concrete slab. But
it was cold this morning.
It was. I know. But you put that to work up your sides if you got a high heat thing. When I was colonizing a few thousand substrate blocks in there, the temp would go up to 80, 85 degrees sometimes.
No shit.
Just from all of those substrates in that enclosed area.
I dig your idea, too, or where you got the idea for the barrel loader from, which I hadn't heard until I just got up here. And you were telling me in your garage about the job heater concept.
Oh, yeah, salamanders.
Yeah, because I've had this idea forever that most mushroom farmers start, not an idea, just this concept that you meet a mushroom farmer and their idea of like how you sterilize, inoculate, incubate, and then fruit something kind of can happen all at once. And you have to sort of break it down when you're trying to do it at scale. But this example of kind of where you got that idea from is where everybody starts. They're like, can this just all happen in one room?
Yeah.
And they get obsessed with this idea until they realize it's not scalable. And I had never seen somebody actually do that.
Well, it could be scalable, I guess. I don't know what he's talking about. I met a guy years ago, pre-internet days, was growing mushrooms. And his idea was he would make up his substrate blocks and he would stack them in his grow room, right where they're going to eventually fruit. And he would stack them up in there, and he had an insulated grow room, and then he had these construction heaters. You guys have seen them, the little cylinders. They run on kerosene or propane, whatever you're using. But in construction, we call them salamanders. But anyway, he cut holes in his grow room, and he put the salamanders outside with them just sticking in, and he'd fire them up and run them overnight. And it would heat the entire inside of his grow room up to around 180 degrees. And he'd leave it overnight, and then the next day he would go in there with his, not the next day, it takes about 3 days to cool off, but he'd go in there when they were cool with his grain spawn and inoculate all of them. And he was successful at it.
I
was blown away. It was a pretty cheap way to sterilize a large number of substrates.
It's wild. And then you just let it go through its cycle,
and then he'd go through a cycle, fruit them, and then, you know... You have to fruit everything, get it done, and then empty your room. You can't have this progressive cycle going because you're going
to
heat your whole grow room up. But
well, it's similar to the cycles of like Pennsylvania. Yeah.
I'm a little curious about that. So did he like change? How did he keep the room sterile while he was inoculating, or did he just?
I don't think he did. You know, we can inoculate pretty much in open air.
So is it sterile? Sequential, like, tinfoilization. He was doing this every day, so that he'd have a kill.
Oh, no, he wasn't doing it every day. He wasn't trying to kill pathogens in the room. He was taking his raw compost and stuff, putting it in bags, and then heating the entire room for enough hours that the bags' contents would pair up. It'd be pasteurization. But it worked, you know. And, yeah, you can, if you're making straw logs or something, you can dump the grain spawn. You can do it outdoors.
Yeah, especially at pasteurization temperatures. It doesn't matter. You're not really sterilizing anything at that degree.
Right.
So.
Well, you don't want it sterile. If you sterilize straw, it's going to go green before you use it.
Yeah. I guess it's the same concept for, like, if anybody's been to the agaricus houses of, like, Pennsylvania, where they just grow in these, like, ratty old, what they call them, doubles. They're fascinating in the degree that they fruit like a whole, you know, series of rooms out. Then they just come in with a boiler and steam everything off in between. So they'll get the whole room up to like 210 and then just shut it down, put new beds in, and sort of cycle it over.
Oh, what he was, I don't even remember back then. I think it was plastic bags. Yeah. I don't think we had any kind of spawn bags back then. So I don't know what he was using. I really don't, but it was plastic. Might have just been poly tubing, like straw like material. I don't know. I don't know what temperature it melts at, but he had that part figured out. Whatever you do, I mean, no matter how hard you work, it's going to be the thing you forgot. All right, well, then you incorporate that, and that's how you learn, you know. And when you finally get where everything you do works, you lose interest. If you're like me, it's like it's not fun anymore.
It's the search, man.
Yeah.
Did you say you were cadmium deficient? Did I just hear that?
I just.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I don't think we want cadmium, really.
No. Those are the best paints in the world, though. I come from like a dumb art background, and Sam would know this, but. There's some picture of me in college, like eating a sandwich with like cadmium red and scarlet all over my hands and a cigarette. I'm like healthy as can be, you know? Yes. I was not cadmium deficient.
Yeah, no. The things we do in college, we tried to do now. That's true. I can just imagine going back to trying to ride dirt bikes again or something.
You know? Oh, God.
Always be broken.
Yeah. That's true, man.
In fact, I'm scared to get on my friend's adventure bikes for that reason. Because I'm thinking, you know, I used to have a little 250 lightweight bike. I could pick it up by myself, throw it in the back of the truck, go dirt riding, you know. And now they got, you know, 800-pound Indians and Harleys and stuff out there riding dirt.
Right.
I don't want that thing to fall on me.
No way, man.
Don't fall. I go, well, why ride a dirt bike if you're not going to fall?
I kind of like this mix of how many mushroom people are into motorcycles. I know there's like a lot of you guys out there. Yeah. It's kind of cool. I don't know what the kinesthetic exchange there is. Like, why?
It's because highly intelligent people gravitate to motorcycles.
Fuck yeah, dude.
And mushrooms do. They're smart people in this room. Mushrooms are hard to grow. And if they were easy to grow and anybody could do it, none of us would be here.
Yeah.
Right? It's because it's hard. And because there's so many variables, you know. We got a dog. I love my dog. I got dogs. They suck when they get into your lab, though.
Yeah.
You know, and shake. It's like, oh, okay. But, you know, we work around it, you know. We find a way to have our babies and grow our mushrooms.
That's true, you know? Man. That's true. I remember Gina. I don't remember his name on Shroomery, but it was James Shoop. He's out of Louisiana. In the first grow room, or at first lab I ever saw in a bedroom, and his cats are like on the other side, and he had just built his lab like out of painter plastic, you know, and his flow hoods just popped up against it. But I never thought to ask. And then years later, when I built my first lab out, I think I was telling you last night, all the cat hair just sucked to the pre-filter.
Yeah.
Fuck, man.
Always use a pre-filter.
Oh, yeah. Cat hair sucks, man.
HEPA filters are expensive.
Yeah, it totally is.
I've still got my flow hood. I used it when I was curing weed. I would keep flow hoods running in the whole room. So as it was hanging to dry, it kept the room clear.
Yeah.
Because the microbial test they give for weed here in Washington, I think you're allowed 1,000 parts per million, which is really, really low.
Yeah.
But... wearing gloves and mask and curing with the flow hood on, I was getting down around 250 to 300.
Damn.
Which is as low as, I mean, I don't know how you can get any lower because I was practically drying in a sterile air.
Yeah.
And then using vinegar and hydrogen peroxide to kill the kill the fungus. I mean, you're talking about how to kill fungus. The wheat forum is down the road. But yeah, you can spray your weed with, mix up some vinegar and hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah.
And you can spray it right on the weed. You can do it day of harvest. It's not toxic. We pour it on ourselves all the time. But it'll kill any mold or yeast or whatever that happens from bad breath when you're out there working on it, whatever. You touch it with your fingers. You got crap all over your fingers. I always work. Is what?
What kind of ratio were you using vinegar?
I'm trying to remember, but I think it was pretty close to one-on-one. Maybe less vinegar. You don't want to spray 3% peroxide. That's a little strong. Cut it in half. Mm. I was getting 30%, and I don't remember the dilution method now. But go online and talk about mixing that. And there's commercial mixes you can get now that are made with it's not hydrogen peroxide, it's hydrogen dye something, but it smells like it. And then the vinegar is, you get it in acetic acid and a high concentration too.
Hydrogen peroxide is tough shit, man. Like if you're, I recommend this to a lot of cultivators out there who have blotch problems. If you had 1/10 of a percentage into your, like, you know, vat of water, if you have a pond fogger or just an inline peristaltic pump, 1/10 of a percent won't really affect mushroom growth, but it will kill bacteria like to an obscene degree.
I don't think peroxide hurts mushrooms much anyway.
Only if it goes above that. It starts doing weird stuff discoloration.
I was dumping it out of the
shit.
Brown bottle on substrates.
On substrates, yeah, but on mushrooms, like as they're developing a room, it'll change.
Themselves.
Yeah, that usually
happens so fast, you don't need to
worry
about it.
Blotch is a weird thing at scale that I've seen. It just gets worse and worse over the years for farms, but.
Oh, man. Ozone,
because you can get a little plasma blocks, they're cheap.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Ozone's an interesting one. I've tried to sterilize a lot of substrate with ozone. I don't remember if there's anybody else here who's fucked with that, but
you can bubble it into water.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes hydrogen peroxide.
It does. Yeah.
What do you use these filters for? Because I would never filter with a filter. I would always filter with a centrifuge.
Filter in terms of what?
Well, you guys are doing cat hair.
This is for hair. We're talking about air filtering.
So it's like laminar flow filtering for like a laboratory setting, so that you're killing all the microbial, you're trapping all the microbial activity in a room so that you can do sterile work.
When you're doing sterile work, you need a totally sterile environment.
Have you ever done a UV curtain?
You don't want to be, you don't want your hand sticking in UV.
Not for that long.
That'd be in a tunnel and you're not.
Yeah, well, we got flow. We don't need to always reinvent the wheel. Flow hoods work really well. You got a HEPA filter about that thick.
I've used one for like 30 years.
Yeah, you keep a good pre-filter on them. The expensive filter will last forever.
They get slower, but they get better with time.
Well, they do.
They're like a fine wine.
As they do slow down, they're filtering more. A dirty filter is more efficient than a clean filter.
That's true.
No, you have the air coming through, so whatever you're pulling it in, it's not. You don't want to be anywhere. You don't want it to shine, but if you have it, your air coming through a thing, you just have it right there, and then it just comes out.
And it acts as sterile air.
Well, you can get air duct UV lights and stuff for it, but that's something different. We don't want to have babies with two noses and four ears. So.
Yeah, a lot of the reason for not having turbulent air like that, too, because a lot of people who are cultivating, for the most part, are doing really fine work in front of what they call laminar flow. And that's because you're trying to have a very like careful sterile technique as you manually transfer like mycelium on an agar dish to grain or to sawdust. And without disrupting that flow and causing like dirty currents to pull into it, you need that sort of nice clean work area. So that's the purpose of that.
You have it on your table in front of you blowing at you.
Right.
We're the biggest source of contaminants ourselves. You know, our bad breath and everything else is what does it. Right. Dirt under our fingernail. So you wear gloves and you have a flow hood coming out. So the flow is coming by laminar. It means every spot on the hood has the same intensity, the same velocity.
Yeah.
So you flick a cigarette lighter and it should bend over without blowing out, and it should be the same everywhere.
Yeah.
That way, as you're working, the dirty stuff is coming back towards you and away from your culture. So.
And he hasn't grown mushrooms in how long? Shit, dude.
It's been decades.
It's funny how this stuff sticks with you, though, and you're just like, I know stupid things about laminar flow.
Well, you do it so many thousands of times over the years. And I'm probably not done growing mushrooms. I'll eventually
get back
and play in it. But I quit when Vivian died. I was growing cubes. It was all about playing and tripping and being wild and shit. And my wife got cancer in 2006, and it was kind of life-changing for us. They don't tell you these days, you got 6 months to live. You know, they phrase it like people in your situation usually survive an additional 6 months. And they try to break it to you that way. Which
right.
So anyway, that was in 2006. She finally died on the end of 2014.
Yeah.
So she made it quite a while, 8 years with essentially a 6-month death sentence. And we were getting
all the different cordyceps powders. John Holliday sent us pounds and pounds of his mixes, and she was making smoothies and trying all that stuff. I went from just cubes and copes and stuff like that to growing shiitake, and we went out and picked lion's mane. It grows all over out in the Cascades, and I guess around here too. But we cloned them and started growing those. Shiitake, oysters, I got deathly allergic to and had to quit. I can't breathe the spores. But anyway, we started doing that. It sort of made a change in my posting habits, Shroomery, too, because I went from pretty much cube advice and, you know, Cyanescens advice, which most of us have to grow outdoors. It takes too long. But I was showing people how to do those. But then when she got sick, it all went to edibles, medicinals, mostly medicinals, and just trying to save her. And when she died, I couldn't do it anymore. I thought, you know, how can I tell people how to grow if I couldn't save her? You know, and she died almost 10 years ago. It's still hard to talk about.
Do you think it would work for her?
Well, it had to have, because she had cancer all over her body for years. And 6 weeks before she died, she took a picture of my dog and I on top of a mountain. She went up the mountain with us and made it to the summit. You know, and part of that was just will. You know, she was probably the strongest willed person I've ever known. So I know the mushrooms helped her. You know, they definitely didn't hurt. She also followed the advice of doctors and did the whole chemo thing and all of that, which just made her sicker, I think. But anyway, that's when I stopped posting at Shroomery, was Christmas 2014. And I only went back a couple of times just to say hi, but my heart was out of it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to grow mushrooms. I didn't want to be around them. I didn't want to talk about them. I didn't want to do anything. And I'm just now coming out of that, really. Pretty long grieving process.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It takes a long time, man. That's part of our weird meeting, is just dead wives, mushrooms, and motorcycles. So it's like, it's strange.
We share in common.
Yeah,
we both lost somebody to cancer.
It's a strange thing. But I think a lot of people in this community in particular are here for that. And they're like kind of interested in the medicinal value of these things. And it's funny to come from just like the total mechanical background. But
it's interesting that Terrence McKenna died of a brain tumor.
That's what my wife died of. Yeah. Right. Right.
How could it have helped him, or did it, or maybe we haven't found what works
yet. Yeah, it's true. Well, I think there's a lot of efficacy for these things in a vacuum, you know, and like you mentioned, a lot of these different molecules and phenotypes to doctors, and it was really inspiring talking to Ken. I forget it's Fruiting Bodies, I guess is the name of they just bailed out of here. But him and his business partner now are sort of going to the degree of talking to doctors about this stuff. And we were talking about it in the lot yesterday, and I was like, you know, one of the things that a lot of the chemo doctors and oncologists would talk to, like, my wife and I about is, like, you know, just, like, you're dead anyways. Don't mix other shit in with your standard of care. So they're approaching it from a standpoint of talking to doctors now and trying to, like, pull them into this concept of really engaging with patients and engaging with companies that are trying to create things that might benefit, and who knows. But you got to start somewhere, you know.
I think they're afraid of giving people false hope.
Totally.
And brain cancer is a different animal. You know, John McCain got it, and he was dead in no time. Yeah. McKenna got it, he was dead in no time. Last year, my dad got a brain tumor, and like 6 weeks, he just got up to go to the bathroom one day and fell, and they found a brain tumor, and 6 weeks, he was gone.
Yeah.
So I don't think in something like that, I don't know how mushrooms are going to help. How can there be a particular food you eat, no matter how healthy, that's going to stop that?
Maybe it's more preventative, because once things have gotten established.
Right.
That's possible, but I don't think we know enough about how they do it.
McCain's, Kennedy's, and Carter's, all their brain tumors were on the side that they hold their phone, and they had the first generation of phone. And your phones, the radios are diddly squat in terms of radiation. It's the damn CPU.
Right,
it's a really broad brush. I have a paper in here that the Japanese, for 15 different cancers, you can take a certain type of nematode, put your urine onto a petri dish, and those nematodes will preferentially swim towards urine that has cancer in it. 90% efficiency out of the paper. I'd love to show anybody in here. Because it will detect at zero stage. So now you start to detect at zero stage.
Right.
Maybe you can start doing a shitload of clinical trials.
Right, to be able to preemptively,
And this group here is going to happen. I guarantee you, 18% of the fucking U.S. economy is healthcare. 5% of the U.S. economy is cancer.
Yeah.
And they don't want that shit solved.
No.
If you solve that shit, guess what happens?
Yeah.
5% of the economy disappears, which is tells you running the economy in a bullshit way.
Yeah, it's a bullshit thing too, because that 5% puts 5% more in our funds to use on other things that we could use.
But and not you, as you measure it, because remember, you measure it off of this bullshit thing called velocity of money, which is exactly the same as velocity.
Not
of money.
Me.
Well, it doesn't, but I know that's what
my money has lots of velocity. It's from my wallet to the bills. But, you know, maybe if nematodes go after cancer, maybe they're actually going after the sugar because.
Yeah, I wonder.
MRI, whatever it is they look at, they'll inject you with sugar and then they can see the sugar. The sugar will accumulate in the cancer tumor. And I think they put a little radiation in with it or something so they can then take a picture of it.
That's what I attribute more than mushrooms. My wife got that done. I forget
the whole process.
We went to the keto diet like at a actually intelligent like a neurosurgeon's suggestion. And it's just starving sugars basically in your body. It turns you over to like just a fat-based digestive system.
Yeah.
It's John McCain was actually in the same hospital, Frank. They're in there at the same time getting surgery.
Oh, wow.
It's fucking weird, man. And this dude, somewhere in the neuro clinic, just kept screaming, I want a potato. And we just were like, I assume that's John McCain, and he wants a fucking potato. Should give the fucking dude a potato, man. But that stuff is weird. I forgot about John McCain or Terrence McKenna, but it's all the same weird. Crossing the blood-brain barrier is like the fun part about studying these mushrooms and seeing if they actually can do that, you know, on any scale.
Got Carter's completely cured with
the immune. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting stuff, man. Yeah.
Anybody got any questions?
Yeah. Shit. The tube growers.
You mentioned earlier, you made the comment, you're like, by that time we figured out brain spawn. Can you elaborate on that process? Because I got blocks up. And
you haven't quite figured out grain spawn?
I don't know. Well, I get my grain spawn, I buy it, but I just want to hear about it.
How we did it?
How did you get to the point of figuring that out?
I read it in one of the books. Back then, there was no internet at that point. And in 72, when I first started growing, which I thought were plants, and I had to learn all about them, I only found that one book. Now, later, I found you can go to any library and ask them to see what's available anywhere else. And so I did find some books, and I don't remember who the authors were now, but grain spawn was being used at least as far back as the 1940s and being sterilized in autoclaves and stuff. It was this whole top secret thing. And the people that knew how to do it wouldn't tell anybody because they wanted to make money. And the mushroom industry was in its infancy, but you could still buy button mushrooms in the stores. But the farms didn't talk to each other, the growers, everybody had to send a spy to get a job somewhere and work at a mushroom farm and then come back and teach people how to do it. That's literally how it had to spread. But I did find a book in, I was in Dallas and I think I drove up to Kansas City to read about, and they wouldn't let me check it out because out of state license, no library card. So I had to sit there and read it and come back the next day and finish reading it. But it showed how to make grain spawn in mason jars. And it was born. They had no filter. What they were doing is turning the lid upside down, kind of like we do with PF Tech, but they turned the lid upside down so it didn't seal. So as you sterilized it, the steams could vent through the upside down lid. Then as it cooled in the pressure cooker, the lid was tight enough to stop the contaminants getting through, but not so tight that it shattered. It wouldn't, it's not going to pull much of a vacuum anyway. It's going to leak, but it would leak into the jars through the pressure cooker, and it wasn't 100%. We first started using filters, I did about a year or two after I did it that way. I was getting maybe a 10% failure rate, which they thought was great, you know, 90% success. And I'm thinking, no, man.
It's a lot of money out the door, dude.
Yeah, and I knew what was happening. It was the jars as they cooled, they were sucking the, you know, they expand when they're hot, and as they get smaller, nature abhors the vacuum, so something's going to fill it,
right.
And that's going to be our house with all the dog hair and cat hair and whatever else, you know. And so we used all different materials. Tyvek never got used, I don't think, until the early 2000s.
Yeah.
First time I remember, I thought, Tyvek, put that on the side of your house.
Right, you know? Right.
But it worked. You know,
yeah, you were cutting up like the old just post office envelopes, right?
Yeah, some of those, and guys were using those. I never had that much luck with them,
no.
To tell you the truth. I did it a few times, but it worked, you know. Anything, you could use a piece of cotton,
right?
You know, because the idea is it's a filter.
Yeah.
So the contaminants get in there and it's pinched, it works. And some of the first things I ever used was my old T-shirts cut up and went from 90% success, maybe 95, something like that. You know, just kept building it.
What compelled you to drive all the way to Kansas City? Why, like, why were you so hell-bent on figuring out grapes?
Knowledge. I wanted to know everything about mushrooms because there's something about them that it attacks our brains. Okay, yeah. We get this virus and we go to sleep. You know, emotional cordyceps. Yeah, so. We're obsessed, and when somebody's hungry for knowledge, they search for it. And it doesn't matter if you're into learning the best techniques for dog grooming or whatever, you're going to go where you need to go to do it. And so there's forums everywhere.
Did you ever know or have any stories about Stephen Pollock?
No. I know who he is and know of him, but I didn't. I thought you were going to say Stephen Peel. It was right. Yeah, oh, no, you can't.
Too.
Yeah.
Who is this strange guy?
Huh? I'll let other people that know, you know, some of the old timers were around and they contributed at various stages to what we did. I'm not an expert on all the people. There was a group of us up here in the PNW that were sharing information with each other. Paul was one of them. And we just would fill each other in on what we had. We'd share pictures and all of that. Paul said he wanted to put my Bible picture in his last book, my mycelium running. I don't know if he's done any since then or not. And he had it at the publisher. And the publisher, 10 Speed Press, I think is where he went back to. They said, man, don't put this in here. Because what's going to happen is you'll get labeled counterculture and you'll lose half your market. If you've got mushrooms on a Bible in your book and that word gets out in churches, they're all going to boycott your book. And you need to be able to sell your book to everybody.
I forget that was your photo. Holy shit.
Yeah, the mushrooms on the Bible.
Mushrooms on the Bible.
I grew mushrooms on a bra. That was my favorite.
That was a good one. Yeah.
Since 2014, as we all know, that mushrooms have become much more mainstream and hundreds of people have gone to start businesses and some of them have even made a decent amount of money. I think anyone who's familiar with your story is just kind of curious. You know, are you satisfied with where things have gone? You don't seem to have any bitterness, but, you know, so many people bootlegged your tape or the Bob Ross growing mushrooms. You know, I know people don't even know your name or, you know, very influenced by your work. And so you seem to be very private. And I'm just curious, you know, do you have resentment that you maybe, like, where's my check? You know, where I can do the wrong.
No, I did for a while. I used to go around YouTube and send them takedown notices and stuff like that. I was just spinning my wheels because 10 more would just pop up. You know, so you can only play whack-a-mole for so long and you get tired of it. But to me, it wasn't about ego or really even the money. I've always made a living from other things than mushrooms. And so it wasn't like I was getting broken or by it. And most of the hard feelings with the old timers was, you stole my tech and you didn't give me credit. You know, and I was like, dude, it's knowledge that's out there. If somebody is teaching how to build a house, are you going to try to go back to the very first carpenter so you can give them credit for how to make a header or something? You know, of course you're not, right? Of course you're not. So the knowledge is out there. And if somebody uses knowledge that they got from watching my video or something, more power to them. They don't have to tell them where they learned it. If somebody asks, tell them. But the knowledge is there, and the knowledge is, no, it doesn't matter what my ego thinks. So no, and I don't, life's too short to be bitter. Losing my wife years ago taught me that. You know, I watched her die slowly without being bitter, you know, and she would be just miserable sick, and somebody would come in and, how are you feeling? And she'd light up, oh, I'm just fine, I'm wonderful. And I learned from that, because she wasn't, you know, she was a good liar, but she didn't want people to suffer with her. So we all have trauma in our life. We all have somebody cheated us somewhere. Now, are we going to go through our whole life bitter because somebody cheated us 20 years ago?
Right.
And there's people that live their life. That's what the whole Spore War thing back in the early 90s, or yeah, late 90s, I guess it was. It was all about ego. And I didn't have any place for that. So I stayed out of that, fortunately, except for Hippie 3. I had to fuck with him a little bit. That was kind of fun. I unbanned him a few days later, and then he was so mad he wouldn't come back anyway.
Are you surprised by how big things have gotten?
I am. I didn't think it was going to take off. But then again, I was riding around on Harleys back in the 70s when only bikers had them. You know, they all looked like us. And that's the only people that rode them, and it was outlaw bikes, you know. And now everybody buys one. You know?
You said you probably aren't done growing in your life. Did you keep any of your cultures?
You know, that's what I'm mad about. I had thousands of cultures. I had a big refrigerator full of them. I had every strain of Holidays, and he's got hundreds, and then a bunch of other ones too that I had collected over the years. I gave them all the way to a lady in the next town over who probably promptly lost them. She called me. I think I made a post at Shroomery that I'm going to get rid of my spores, or my culture library. And the first person who wants to drive up here and get them. And the lady from the next town over, hey, I'll come get them. I'm this at Shroomery. And I hadn't been posting regular, so I didn't know who it was. So she came over and I just got a dolly and wheeled the whole refrigerator out there, gave her the fridge and the cultures and everything.
Do you remember sending cultures to a dude named Fabio in Italy?
Oh, Fabio, yeah, hell yeah.
Fuck, he sent them to me like 10 years after, so I have them.
Those are my cultures.
Yeah, yeah, fuck you.
Yeah. You know, he sent me an email a year or two ago.
He's the fucking shit, man.
Crazy as we are.
He's batshit.
Did you meet him?
No, I tried to go over there and he kept avoiding me because he's like, oh, I don't know, I'm not mushroom growing anymore, and like, now I letterpress, and no, I'm farming, and fuck you. And I was like, all right, cool, dude. He's a fucking cool
ghosted
guy, though.
Ass,
he ghosted me, ass. And I went all the way to fucking Italy. Yeah. You remember Fabio?
Hello, Fabio. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, he's a cool cat. That was 20 years ago, I think. Shit.
Yeah, and then he sent him to me maybe 10 years ago now. And he was like, dude, I've done mushroom growing. So he handed him off.
What did he give you?
He gave me a Hericium, all the shiitakes, which I'm sure came from John. Probably.
The shiitakes came from John. The Hericiums are probably mine.
They're probably
right,
yeah,
up here in the PNW.
Yeah, yeah. So I still have them.
Yeah.
Because I obsessively keep things.
Well, change them now and then. Keep a popsicle stick in your test tubes.
Yeah.
What's it? No, I didn't know there was one. Roger Rabbit strain. Well, where's my check?
Oh, it's a king.
No, I had no idea. There's PE6, which is a really weird thing. It was the Red Sport Cubensis cross to a Texan. And it just came out weird. And I think those are still being sold by the Spore vendors.
PD6, yeah. You crossed that?
That was mine. Yeah, that was mine.
Is that what you're talking about? Was that the... No. That's a cube strain, though, that you're referencing? Okay, no shit. Maybe it's an O2.
I have to go to Bob and order one, I guess. Is Sportwork still in business? Bob Hess? Still
yeah. Around?
I don't know if he ever had that one or not.
P6?
Yeah.
I don't know how it got out there, but that's what everybody orders.
I sent out a bunch of them. They were calling it Peg. And people were growing Peg. And it's because I write a 6 kind of sloppy. It looks like a G. So I sent out a bunch of Sport Prints, and people just started growing. I'm like, man, this Peg is great. And I'm going like, what's Peg? What's Peg? And then I saw it. I go, man, that's one of my cultures. That's PE6. And it was, it wasn't the Red Spore either. PE6, PE is from Penis Envy. It was a Penis Envy crossed, I think, with Texan or something like that. But I had an isolated PE that was really good and an isolated Texan that was really good.
Yeah.
And I put them both on a plate together just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And when they merged, a third growth that was different from either one of the two came right out of the spot where they were growing together.
No shit.
Well, that's interesting. So I got that. And it was kind of a Texas, which is not penis-shaped at all, but it was a Texan with a very small cap.
Really?
Like a Penis Envy and a thicker stem and stuff. It was really kind of a cross. So, and I had labeled several of those. I had PE1, PE2, PE3, and the PE6 was the best. And people that had it, thinking it was Peg, they're passing it all around Shrimery. We were all sending spore prints to each other all the time. So they were passing it all around. And then it got to the Ralphster, got it, and a few others, and started selling them to everybody. So, I never made a dime, but I don't care. Wasn't about the money. Yeah.
So I've listened to you. So you put these two different strains on an aggregate.
Yeah.
Is that the way you get new strains? I've always wondered how you...
It's one of the ways, yeah. But that's... normally, that process is used in the commercial strains. You'll have an isolate. All right, so if you put an isolate on a Petri dish, you're not going to see all these myriad of sectors going out in all different directions, okay? It'll be one uniform strain, okay? It'll all look alike. And if you're going to cross two of them together, I was playing around to see if I could do some cross species, you know, cross a shiitake to something else. And, you know, just shit to do, you know. Never told anybody about it because it didn't work. All right, so never say what you're working on until it works. Then you're a genius, you know. If you go out and broadcast it first and it doesn't work, you throw it away, and people ask later, it's like, it got moldy. You know? But yeah, that's one of the ways you do it. But normally when people are trying to create new strains of anything, edible or whatever, they'll go back to spores. You know, just go back to spores and start fresh. Because eventually, mycelium's going to senesce, you know, some quicker than others. You can offset it a little bit, go into different substrates and things like that. But eventually, you're going to want to go back to spores.
Yeah, there's like infinite possibilities.
But think about, you know, if you can expand mycelium a million times, think about how many times a test tube can be put into a different test tube. So if you literally do it right and keep them refrigerated, you should be able to make your strains last your lifetime easily.
Yeah, we do the cryo storage, and that stuff is unreal, man. It's really interesting to just see things like in cryo on rye berries stored like fucking Walt Disney, you know, and it lasts a long, long time.
At what temperature?
Negative 80 Celsius. It's pretty incredible. You have to have a cryoprotected.
Yeah, because I tried freezing and it killed it.
Yeah, it killed them. Yeah. Yeah, because it forms ice crystals. So when you're freezing phenotypes like that, you have to have a cryoprotectant on some sort of agar. And then it will sort of like, you know, be very careful to like not form those ice crystals as it freezes and then thaws. So it's an interesting process, but it's used for every other biological preservation technique. So.
Yeah. I just tried throwing it in the freezer to see what would happen.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about Stephen Poole from Florida?
Oh, yeah.
I've got a PhD from him.
Oh.
It's probably worth the ink that was, you know, used in its printing. But, you know, he's one of the guys that was in there early. growing mushrooms, collecting them in Florida and selling them and stuff. And he started his little mycological university. And, you know, people got some good information out of it. It's not a real PhD course, though, you know, even though he's somehow got accredited from something. I don't really know what it was. In fact, I'm not even sure I still have it. But at one point, I had my name on a PhD, and I thought, oh, Dr. Keith, that don't sound right. That don't sound right at all. So, but anyway, you know, he and I argued over and over again because he kept saying you can take a jar that has trick and put it out in the sun with the trick facing the sun, and it'll kill the trick. And I called bullshit before I even tried it, you know, because glass is UV filter. So I don't know what's going to kill it.
It's the heat.
The heat is going to kill the mushroom too. It doesn't. Right. But anyway, I did it just for grins and giggles, and I watched that green spot just get bigger and bigger. So no, Steve, it does not work that way. Otherwise, there wouldn't be trick in the forest. All right, go hiking the Cascades, and I'll see entire trees. I used to shiver when I was growing mushrooms because I'd hike right past a tree that's just literally covered with it.
It's
everywhere. And I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have to get undressed on the porch before I go in and
the
get
paranoia
all the clothes
sets
washed
in.
And go straight to the shower. You know? Anybody else got any questions other than how to grow mushrooms?
Why Roger Rabbit?
And why that avatar? So
I'm trying to remember, and I think Roger first came in. People started calling me Roger when I took him flying, because every time a controller would say something, you know, tell me turn such and such a heading, I go, yeah, Roger. They're like, man, you said Roger, so I'm just going to call you Roger. And that was about the time the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out. And Jessica Rabbit, anybody else watched that, was like three kinds of hot, right? And so my avatar isn't Jessica Rabbit. She was different. But the avatar, somebody sent me and told me he drew it. He goes, here, I drew this for you. I thought, holy shit, a pink bunny with big boobs, you know, right up my alley, you know. So, that just kind of became my avatar. And I settled on Roger Rabbit. I was in the alt drugs mushroom days and early Mycotopia. I think I had Sky Pilot with two Y's.
Yeah.
But there was a song, a rock song back in the day, Sky Pilot, how high can you fly? And I remember that thinking, oh, I got to learn. That's one of that song, in fact, inspired me to get a pilot license.
No shit. What year did you get a pilot license?
How high can you fly? Shit. 50 years ago almost.
All that shit
was going on at once. Yeah. I had a grandfather that flew.
Yeah.
And up in Alaska, anybody knows Knik Glacier, just outside of Anchorage, big gravel, like a mile of just flat gravel, probably 3 or 4 miles now.
Yeah.
But he had a little T-craft, a little Taylor craft, 65 horsepower motor, and he taught me to land on that. And I was 12, I think, or 13. And you're not legal to solo a plane until you're 16. Can't get a license till 17. But he told me, he goes, you reach the pedals fine. He'd been letting me fly a lot. And he goes, if you can do 3 takeoffs and landings from this gravel bed and I don't have to tell you what to do or touch the controls, he goes, I'll solo you.
Oh, fuck,
you know? I'm not even fully puberty yet. He's going to let me fly the airplane. And so I did. I nailed 3 takeoffs and landings, and he opened the door and got out. See you, Grandpa, man. But then I went on and got my license when I was old enough. But I've always kind of been an outlaw that way. I got it from my grandpa. It skips a generation. You know, my grandpa was pretty wild. And then my dad was straight Sunday go to church, you know, assistant preacher and all of that. But that was his thing. You know, he had to rebel against his dad. You know, I'm not going to be like that. And I'm thinking, Dad, you're cool, but I like Grandpa, you know. He's ornery, you know. I watched him walk off the job once because Grandma, I was there for the summer and he took me to work. He was a welder at a place in Pampa, Texas, built trailers.
Oh, shit.
So he taught me to weld with a coat hanger and a car battery. He says, if you can weld a good bead with that coat hanger and car battery, I'll let you use my machine. Right?
Fuck yeah.
But some guy came in. Anyway, Grandma came in with our lunch, and Grandma had big things. And this guy made a comment that wasn't intended for Grandpa to hear, but he did. And he went over there and just knocked the guy out. You know? Just dying. I'm like, Dad would never do that. You know, I'm like, fine. And he comes to me and goes, come on, let's go. He picks up his tools and he leaves. He goes, I'm not going to let them fire me. He goes, they're going to fire me for doing that. He goes, I'm going to quit first.
Fuck yeah.
And we just went. I never saw somebody do something like that, you know. But yeah, Grandpa was cool. So I look.
It does skip a generation. My dad might have been cool, but my grandfather was cooler. He would just like, if somebody beeped at him, he would just like, and this is back when there was no latches on hoods, he would just get out of the car and just open their hood and rip their horn wires out, put the hood down and get back in the car and drive away. Like, he didn't give a fuck. It was so great. Oh my God.
Yeah. Ornery things we could pull in the day. Now you go up anywhere close to somebody's car and it starts beeping.
That's true. There is no horn wire. Fuck. Yeah.
And now my motorcycle does that. So. Never had a motorcycle with an alarm before.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he's got our DVDs. I'm not trying to make a spout of selling, but if you want some keepsake of a DVD, if you actually have a DVD player, he has a saddlebag full of those.
I brought about 30 or 40 or something like that.
Yeah, you know?
But they're in the motorcycle. They're out in the saddlebags.
Yeah.
Most people, I quit selling them years ago. Everybody... It got so expensive to order. You had to order like 10,000 to get them
right.
At a price that I could sell them for $49 and not lose my
fucking
butt.
Because
I wanted them professionally done. So I just quit ordering. Once it went online and it was going on the torrent sites. And that's why I put it online myself, because I wasn't getting anything from torrents at all. And then... when it went on my own site at $9, I think most people started doing that. And there's still a few people buying the downloads even now, you know.
Yeah.
Two or three a day.
That's good.
Beer money.
It's beer money, dude. Yeah. Chopper gains money and beer money.
I had to give up most of my beer drinking. It was giving me high blood pressure. I'm not eating enough mushrooms. So.
Yeah. Any more questions? You guys are good? You're sick of us?
Do you eat mushrooms today?
I love to eat mushrooms. I don't feed him mushrooms when he comes because you know, he
fuck
eats
mushrooms.
Them all the time.
Yeah.
I remember we were eating the other day. You know, I didn't even cook mushrooms because I know when I was traveling to see mushroom people, that's all they want to do. Look at these mushrooms they cooked. Or here's some cubes. You want a trip? I'm like, no, not today, you know. Not today.
It is funny. I think most of my employees are more healthy than I am because they're just trimming like blocks and making bags for themselves or whatever. And I'm just like, I just go eat steak and mac and cheese. Fuck it. I don't know, dude.
I try to eat mushrooms a couple times a week at least.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, man.
Would you still use the Tyvek sleeves in your gusset bags? I don't see anybody doing that.
Well, you know, that was...
Dude, we just talked about that
this
morning.
We were just talking about it at breakfast.
Yeah.
It's not conducive to high-speed machinery. You know, it's labor-intensive. Because you want to fold your bags in such a way that when they expand, because they're going to, steam is, 1,000 times or 10,000 times more area than water. So the moisture that's in that bag... it's going to turn into steam and it's got to go somewhere or you'll explode your bag and you don't want your filter patch loaded. So having the bag unsealed and accordion folded so it can kind of raise up a little bit lets it push that steam out. And then as it cools, it pulls the vacuum even with the Tyvek sleeve. And it works like a charm, but it works for people that are home growers, experimenters. If you're trying to do 50,000 bags in a day, it's too labor intensive, you know, and
yeah, it's one of
we ought to work
issues,
on a machine
like,
that can insert something. If you've got high speed machines, you should be able to make some kind of an inserter.
Something,
and
that
it doesn't
does
have
it,
to be I just had Tyvek wrist sleeves with elastic on them, and I was using them. But you could probably get rolled Tyvek at the exact right size. What?
Yeah.
Build something.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people who are like adjacent to that industry. So Unicorn Bags is this interesting concept, right? Garrett Wilkerson like started the what the fuck is it called? Some pentagram bags, whatever it is. Pegasus bags, right. So he...
It's just smaller scale.
Oh, totally, yeah. So he's just buying from Unicorn and selling out. So he made a meme. This I never told you this, but it was just like, who invented this dumbass fucking Tyvek sleeve bullshit tech? And he's just making fun of it. And he grows like really small amounts of mushrooms. And I remember that from way back when. It's the first way I ever made grain spawn bags in autoclave, just because you're the dude, man. And I didn't know that, but yeah. And we now use those autoclaves that do pressure cycles. And those vacuum-style autoclaves create such a heavy pulse of steam in and then pulling down to vacuum, like a real vacuum, up the steam. It's a crazy bomb of a fucking machine. But your filter patch needs to come in contact with your substrate, otherwise the bag will just explode. So one of the concepts that we were talking about was a unicorn. We had them make these bags for us with patches that are a little bit lower. So when we fold them over, the patch actually comes in contact with the grain. So when it goes in the autoclave, it doesn't explode. Unicorn sold Lou's out. He's, you know, old and retiring now. And those guys who now own it, it's part of like an oil conglomerate. They're doing away with all specialty bags. So they're doing like four bags. They're like, fuck your order. And I was like, dude, I order pallets at a time of this shit. So we started talking about it this morning as if like there's some other way to be able to relieve that pressure through some sort of sleeve. And it is totally applicable when you're doing things under pressure. In a fucking steam box or something, it doesn't matter, you know, for substrate bags. But for spawn, it really does matter.
But to answer the question why Tyvek sleeves, it was because I got tired of blowing up bags.
Yeah.
Open a pressure cooker and your grains are all over everywhere and your bags are blown all the way up against the sides. You know, they got pressure in them. And,
yeah.
A couple of times doing that, you think, okay, these things have to vent. You
know, right.
You got to find a way to vent them. And if you try to vent through the filter patch, it overwhelms it.
Yeah.
And screws it up. You know, there's so much steam leaving and then so much air, because when it makes a vacuum, it has to come back, you know? And so you've got all this flow back and forth through your filter and it overwhelms it.
Yeah.
Where the Tyvek sleeve lets it go up that way and out. So it gets rid of the pressure and it still pulls down tight enough to seal. But like I say, it's labor intensive. It's fine if you're growing as a hobbyist. You know, you can sit there and take your time and position them exactly right and get the jar rings all around so the bags are all separated and all of that. But for a big commercial operation, I don't know. That's why I was thinking a Tyvek sleeve around if you're going to sterilize in pallets, something you could wrap around the entire for shipment too, because you've got the same thing.
Right.
He was talking about shipping things on airplanes.
Yeah.
They have a cabin altitude.
See, Amanda, it's all about you, right?
Yeah.
Jesus, fuck.
Well, airplanes have a cabin altitude of 7,500 feet. So if you load your substrate bags at sea level,
right,
like
right.
we are here, and then you take them up to 7,500 feet cabin altitude, they might be flying at 40 or 35, but they pressurize the cabin at 7,500. Well, as you're climbing up to 7,500 pressure altitude, your bags are puking air through the filter out, you know? And now, when you go back down again, it goes back in, and you'll get contamination from that.
Thus, why when you emailed me, Sam, about SACO 2 bags is why we stopped using them. Because that free matrix just allows for, like, pow, pow, to happen, like, as the plane's going up, so contamination just gets sucked the fuck in. Mm-hmm. SACO 2 makes a great bag, just don't ship spawn, you know, by a plane.
That's why I was thinking of a Tyvek wrap for the whole pallet.
Yeah, right.
Give it an extra filtering mechanism. And maybe the Tyvek patch for the pallet might have a bigger filter of some kind of fiber type material that'll flow large amounts.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. Something to work on.
It's the fun rabbit holes.
Buy me an airplane and we'll fly them up and down and test them.
I'm down.
Do some
we talked about this last night. Yeah, dude. You got the license. I got the cheese.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
She'll hire you on just to get her spawned.
Where you want me to have? Where do you live?
He's dead fucking serious, too. Yeah.
Oh, that's too far. No, I don't want to. I don't want to do actual work anymore. I'm retired.
It's motorcycles.
If I got to actually work, I'm going to polish my motorcycle. Yeah. Or something,
you know? What did Hippie 3 close that made you ban him on the shore?
I don't even remember. I think, yeah, no. Oh, we were always digging at each other all the time, you know. He banned me from Micotopia a couple of times. And then he called me back and, come on, man, I need your moderator over there. I'm like, well, you're going to ban me every time you get a hair sideways, but you want me to come back and moderate your forum? No. No, I think what he did, I think I told him off in a private message. And Shroomery has a rule, you don't post private messages, okay? You just don't, all right? It's a betrayal of trust. And I sent him a private message, and he posted my private message on Micotopia. So I banned him at Shroomery for doing that. And God, I didn't know he was sick. If I knew he had heart disease, I probably wouldn't have sent his blood pressure through the roof like that, you know?
You're just feeling bad now because you got blood pressure,
now.
Dude.
I know. I got high blood pressure.
Going,
oh, shit.
Yeah.
I was supposed to get surgery last month, and they checked my blood pressure, and the anesthesiologist goes, nope. And the surgeon came in, nope. That was like 200 over 115 or something. And they go, are you real nervous? I go, it's a little hernia surgery. I'm not nervous at all. I'm just always wired, you know, and I didn't realize until I actually got my blood pressure normal. It's like, oh, this is what it's supposed to feel like.
Yeah, you this know? Is more.
I thought you're supposed to be like this all the time.
There's a big difference from the time we saw you like a month ago till now. You've mellowed the fuck out. I just thought you were smoking more weed, but it's blood pressure.
I probably am. And I quit drinking so much too.
Right, right. That's and key. That's,
that was driving my blood pressure. Shit, I was.
Yeah.
I don't really drink beer until summer comes. And then when it gets hot and I'm out mowing the lawn and working on the motorcycle and, it's, you know, you start drinking beer. And next thing you know, I was going down and getting a half rack every afternoon and started getting a big old gut. I had to starve myself for the last month. So,
yeah,
you know, one of those things was a little wake-up call. We get those from time to time. Yeah, man.
I was looking to say you were moderating. And I don't know how these things work, but it just seems like a ton of work. Are you reading everybody's posts to make sure they're not spouting bullshit? Or?
No, I didn't have time for that. I did for a while, but spouting bullshit's part of the game, you know?
And there's insults, too.
Well, the insults, yeah, people don't need to be shitty to each other. But you can't really, if somebody was giving flagrant disinformation, I would step in and correct it. And I did a lot of that. A lot of those posts at Shroomery are correcting, you know, where somebody just flat out said something like, do your sterile work in the oven, you know. And you kind of, I couldn't let that stuff slide. And I had my own pet peeves, you know. Don't call the metabolites mushroom piss. That just makes me mad. That's not what it is, you know. If so, then that's what penicillin is, you know. These metabolites for mushrooms have all kinds of compounds that, you know, we've been using for decades now.
What do they call it now? All the nutraceutical companies call it exudate. They got a new term.
Exudate. Yeah, well, that's...
I started hearing that. I was like, wow. Yeah, yeah, they're just saying it a little cleaner.
I guess that's what it is. You know?
Yep.
So, yeah, you know. But I don't know. I haven't been on the forums in a long time. I would imagine not a whole lot has changed. I don't know. I know my stepdaughter goes on social media, and I start hearing things flying through her bedroom because she's so mad. And I don't know what group she's going to. They're not mushroom groups, but apparently people are still as cruel as they always have been, you know. And a lot of people get off on insulting people online, which I never really saw a whole lot of point in, except with Hippie 3. You know? I made one exception, you know. And I can't talk bad about him because he's deceased, you know. So, but we argued with each other. We were pretty tight. I think he was in Kansas City. I was going to fly down there once and get him. He wanted to ride. I know I sent him a whole box of Cuban cigars because I was going over to BC, and you can buy them up there. And so I'd smuggle them across the border and have Cuban cigars. And sell them to people. And I know I sent him a box for free. And then I grew mushrooms on a box, and it was a really shitty grow, so I never posted it. I was like $500 box of Cuban mushrooms, so I thought, what a wasteful idea to grow cubes on these, you know, because cubes grow on everything. I thought, they grow on everything. Yeah. You know, you take these blue jeans, water them up, sterilize them, and grow cubes. They grow in a bra, for crying out loud. Yeah. And they didn't work hardly at all. I wasted a whole box of good cigars. I learned a method that does not work. It wasn't a failure.
Straight Edison that. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Don't try to grow on tobacco.
Just smoke the tobacco.
Yeah. Yeah. I have my once a year cigar and glass of hot bourbon. Used to have one of those brandy tumblers, put a candle under it, warm it up.
Oh, yeah.
So warm bourbon, glass of ice water, and a Cuban cigar. And a bowl, and you got everything. Life is good.
On top of the world.
Yeah, man. So are we done? Be gone. Going around the circle. Thank you. Thank you.
Who's next?
Listen to his podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Too many interviews if you're not sick of him already. Oh, yeah.
I posted what he did. This is Roger Rabbit, the strain.
Oh, wow.
I might be able to turn me.
Oh. Hey, it's good to meet you, too, dude. Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited to hear what you guys are up to. What did you think of that episode? If you want more of this Micah wizardry, stay tuned, because we are turning up the heat. We are shooting for a release a week on MicahWizards.com and a release a week on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, Slinger, Stitcher, Bewitcher, really, you know, wherever the fuck you get your podcast. So be on the lookout for that ear candy, because it's coming your way. This podcast is produced and sponsored by Main Cap and Stem. Need cultures, spawn, substrate, equipment, raw materials, consultations? Reach on out to the amazing team of Cap and Stem at www.capnstem.com. If you want to support this podcast, swing on over to MicoWizards.com and become a member of the largest culture bank on the fucking planet. Seriously, our team is focused on bringing you commercial, gourmet, and experimental cultures from around the globe. So become a member of our culture club at MicoWizards.com today. Don't dig the flow hood work? That's okay. Come on in for the videos, the deep dives, the exclusive interviews, and pheno flicks. Yeah, that's what we're calling them. Motion picture flicks focused on the phenotypes we are working with every day. Don't want videos? Don't dig the fungus on dishes? Just want to support this podcast? Well, shit, you can do that too for $5 a month to keep this show on the road. Speaking of the road, I have to send a special thanks to the new and improved and magical and mysterious Micah Wizards team, consisting of Mr. Michael Vance, Dr. Daniel Ashley, as well as Tyler Crawford and the Flowhood man, Sir Gregor Jones. Okay. I'm Eric Lohman. Stay weird, my Micah Wizard family, and hopefully we'll see you out there in hyperspace, space, space, space. I like that effect.